This podcast is a Majestic Giraffe production. For more information and more content, visit majesticgiraffe.com.
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
So I'll be asking these gentlemen some questions, and you guys will be asking them questions too. And if you guys have questions and want to start lining up, we'll be taking a line over here on the side of the room, and we'll be getting to that at the midway point. So first things first, if you guys want to introduce yourselves to start with, we can start at the end with Tim.
Timothy Zahn, written 10 Star Wars.
Now is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm still Timothy Zahn. Written 10 Star Wars books, some number of short stories, and I'm eagerly waiting Lucasfilm and Disney's new book program. Looking forward, especially if they ask me to be part of it.
My mic is on, and I'm Kevin Anderson from the start, Kevin J. Anderson, and I've written a total of 54 projects for Star Wars, including Tales of the Jedi comics and the Jedi Academy trilogy and Darksaber and the Young Jedi Knight series and Jabba's Palace pop-up book. Hey, I got paid more per word on that thing than anything else I've ever done. And also, because I'm also a publisher, and I'd like to show off, because we've done two books, 5x5, Volume 1 and Volume 2. The first one has it's five military science fiction novellas by five military science fiction writers. And the first one has a piece by me, a piece by Aaron Alston, a piece by Mike Stackpole, and two other guys. The second one has a piece by me, a piece by Aaron Alston, a piece by Bill Dietz, Brad Torgerson, and R.M. Melick. And we want you all to pressure Mr. Zahn here to do one for Volume 3. He's been invited, but we wait for it. Anyway, these are in the dealer's room. Tell him to stop writing Star Wars stuff so he has time to do one of these. Well, wait, maybe there won't get too much support for that one here. Know your audience, Kevin. Anyway, we have a table in the dealer's room. It's table number 203. Remember that, because there are no numbers in the dealer's room and you can't find it anyway.
Use the force.
Yes. Howdy, I'm Aaron Alston, and I have a mic in front of me and one to my right, which is kind of unusual.
That's your one, Aaron.
What?
That's your one.
Sorry, that's one, yes. What with the temporary, you know, confusion as to what's going to be the publishing program for Star Wars, having been resolved yet, I haven't been doing any Star Wars in the last year or so. So this is my year of short fiction. As Kevin indicated, I have stories in both 5x5 1 and 2. I've also got fiction in the new Gene Wolfe tribute anthology, Shatters in the New Sun, which came out only about 4 days ago, and one in Ray Guns Over Texas, which is the Lone Star Con 3 souvenir anthology, which is coming out, actually came out today at the Lone Star Con in San Antonio, Texas. Which I'm not attending because I love Dragon Con.
I get to teach writing here, which I greatly enjoy. I'm on this panel because I started the X-Wing series, and I wrote, which Aaron very ably took over, thank goodness. And I wrote iJedi and I collaborated on a couple of novellas with Tim, and so I've done short work, long work in that field. And the comics, that's right, the X-Wing comics, including Union, The Marriage of Luke and Mara Jade. The latest book that I had come out is World of Warcraft, Vol'jin, Shadows of the Horde, which most people have not seen this because Well, one, there are only a few bookstores left in America. I think you may remember what they used to be. And apparently Barnes & Noble and Simon & Schuster, the publisher of this book, were having a pissing match. So for 2 months, Simon & Schuster has bought one copy of each book to put in their store. So once it's gone, it is gone. So if you're interested in just a good old fantasy novel and stuff like that, you can find it. Apparently it's been selling really well as an ebook because of that. So yes, the old world publishing problem still plague us all. And as Kevin said, I was in 5x5, number one.
Sorry, I missed. This was the self-promotion part of the show. So yeah.
just
to throw out, we've got these promo cards for a game that a guy and I are working on trying to get kickstarted. We'll probably start the Kickstarter program in about 2 weeks. But it'll be a 4x4 game along the lines of Master of Orion. And we're going to be using a bunch of my aliens from various books in them. So if you liked Icarus Hunt, the Calixiri will be in it. Conquerors, the Gierge will be in it. You'll be playable characters and such. So pick up some of these things. They sent me 2,000. I do not want to have to take them home. Give them to friends. You know, I went to Dragon Con and had a great time. I brought you this. There are codes on the back that'll be valuable, we hope, once the thing gets going. So come up when we're done. Grab. We've got ton of them, so
and Tim will sign every single one, all 2,000.
And the ones I don't get, Mike will get.
That's right.
So the first question I want to ask you guys is, I don't think we could assemble four other people on Earth and have them have written such a huge swath of the Star Wars universe. And I want to ask each of you guys in turn, and we can start with Mike, what of all the material for Star Wars you wrote, what's the piece you're most proud of and why?
Boy, I guess for me it would probably be I, Jedi, because one, it was written first person, and two, I really felt that it was necessary at that time in the program to have a book that showed someone's journey in learning about the Force and becoming a Jedi from his point of view, someone that we didn't know from the movies and stuff. And so that was that one just makes me real, real happy.
And is that the only Star Wars novel to date that's written in first person like that?
I assume so, but I don't know.
So. Okay. Aaron?
Yeah, it's kind of a struggle for me to answer that. For years and years, the answer was pretty simple, and that was Starfighter Svadimar. It's not necessarily that I thought it was a better book than the others I did in the Star Wars line, but it was, for me, the easiest and most pleasurable. I kind of struggled with the Wraith Squadron trilogy because it had been dropped on me in kind of an awkward way, and I was not prepared for it. So I had to ramp up and do a hell of a lot of research all at once and put it out and had no idea how it would do. With Starfighters of Adumar, they came to me and said, yeah, we'd kind of like to wrap up the, you know, we have one more book in the Bantam series before it goes to Del Rey, and pretty much you can write anything you want. What do you got? So I pitched Starfighters of Adumar, and they liked it, and I wrote it, and it was a breeze. It was so simple and so easy to write, and it went over very, very well with the reading public. And so for years, that was my favorite. A year ago, August, Mercy Kill came out, and although it was 13 years later, it was a series immediate follow-up to Starfighters Vadimar, number 10 in the series, and Starfighters was 9. And I still don't know which of them I prefer because I'm still too close to Mercy Kill, but I would say they're neck and neck. I just don't know which one is number one yet.
Kevin?
Well, that's kind of like saying who's your favorite child, but
and what's your choice?
I only have one, so that's easy for me to pick. I wrote quite a few Star Wars books, and I was, because of this art book I did with Ralph McCorry, I was up at Skywalker Ranch every month digging through the art archives. And the Lucasfilm person came up to me and said, you know, Kevin, we've been thinking and kind of looking at our audience, and do you think that there might be any young adult fans for Star Wars? And I was like, duh. I was more respectful at the time. And so they asked me to create and do a young adult series called The Young Jedi Knights that I wrote with my wife, Rebecca. And they signed us up for 3 books, and we turned in the first one. And they called us a week later and said, oh, well, this is good. Do 6. And then we did 11, and then we did 14. We did 14 books in 42 months. That's every 3 months. We didn't miss a single deadline, and they kept coming out. And they were very popular, and we got a lot of, library talks, and people liked them. But I got a letter, a handwritten letter, a two-page letter, from this kid saying he just had to write me this letter because he was miserable, he hated his life, he was flunking out of school, he was a drug addict, he was an alcoholic, he was in eighth grade. His parents were splitting up, he was having a horrible life, and he got in a shouting match with his mother, and she locked him in his bedroom and told him he couldn't come out for, a day or something like that. And he had nothing in his bedroom except for our novel, Lightsabers, Young Jedi Knights number 4, in which the Young Jedi Knights build their own lightsabers, and one of them kind of phones it in, and the lightsaber fails, and somebody gets injured. And this kid said, I sat there, and I read this book, and I realized that, you don't just get everything. You have to work for it. You have to train for it. You have to devote yourself to it. And I decided that I didn't like my life and I wanted to turn it around, and I decided to focus on school, and I gave up drugs and I gave up cigarettes and gave up drinking, and he sent me his report card, which was straight A's. And I got another letter from him 3 years later when he was on the dean's list in college. So.
And look at Aaron now.
Yes. So yeah, that's my proudest stuff.
Tim?
And I was supposed to follow
top
back.
That one.
This is our dominance behavior, by the way. This is what we do.
That's right, yeah.
I've had people tell me that they learn to enjoy reading from my books, but nothing that
I made it up.
Yeah. But that is what really makes the long hours struggling over a book and wondering if anybody cares. That's what makes it worthwhile. As to which book I would pick, it's so hard because I see my 10 books as kind of a single story where I keep filling in little pieces here and there. If I had to pick two, which I wasn't authorized to do, but what the heck.
Please, go ahead.
It'd probably be a toss-up between Outbound Flight, because it's so enjoyable building some of Thrawn's backstory and inventing the tactics he would use, and Scoundrels, which was just so much fun to write. I enjoyed Ocean's 11, both versions, and just to be able to put something like that in Star Wars was a real kick. So I'll pick both of those, because Aaron says I can.
Presumably, you guys were all Star Wars fans before you got to write, and I'm wondering how you guys handled, or if you got nervous at all before you started writing, what that was like the first time you stepped into the universe. And Tim, you want to start that?
The call came from my agent, November 1989. We talked 45 minutes to an hour about this project that had just been offered to me, and I panicked for the rest of the evening. Because, yes, the chance to do Star Wars in an era nobody had been allowed to write in before, with all the major characters, was going to be the crowning point, or at least the takeoff point for my career, or it was going to be me failing like crazy in front of hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah, so the flop sweat was coming. It was exhilarating and terrifying at the same time. Bear in mind also, I'd never done a trilogy before. I'd done interconnected novels, but I'd never done a single story in three volumes. And that's trickier than a lot of people realize. By the next morning, I had enough idea. I thought, okay, I can give this a shot. And I went ahead and accepted. But yeah, the terror was never very far below the surface of, can I really pull this thing off?
It took me a nanosecond because it was so darn cool. Except I had to follow him up. So, but what, just to put some things in perspective here, because a lot of times, it's been, when was yours published, Tim? 93?
91.
Back then, quote unquote, Star Wars is dead. I mean, there was nothing with Star Wars that it had been 6-7 years after Return of the Jedi that it was a dead franchise. And Tim, you may know more than I did, but as I understand it, Lou Aronica at Bantam Books got the idea to do more Star Wars books, and he was the deputy publisher at Bantam, and he said he wanted to do them, and everybody at Bantam Books just said, why? It's a dead franchise. What is there something new? What do we not know? And he said, no, I want to do Star Wars. I think the fan base is out there, and he told me this, so I'm pretty sure it's true. He said, and I want to do them in hardcover. And they basically said, you're totally insane. And he said, I want to do them in hardcover, and if you don't let me, I quit. He put his job on the line. And if Tim had turned in a bad book, you would have been responsible for a whole bunch. So, and Tim did his trilogy, which, well, actually, I started writing when you just came out with book two. So it was all new territory. These guys are like come latelys. We did all the work for them already.
Yeah.
But I had a blast, so.
I would say the terror doesn't begin to describe it, but for different, very different reasons. Some of you may have heard this story before, because I've had the opportunity to tell it before, but I was at a convention called CoastCon with Mike Stackpole, and with Tom Dupre, who was then the editor of the Star Wars line for Bantam, and met Tom, and I won't begin to describe all the mistakes I made when I'm meeting him.
Wait for me, I'll do that.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Mike will do that for me. But as it turned out, Mike had been asked to do four X-Wing novels, and then they came to him and asked him to do four more, and he did not have the time and gave them, as I understand it, a short list of writers he would recommend for the continuation of the series.
Nope, not that story at all.
Okay.
You're listening to the Alan Varney version.
Okay. But that's actually all irrelevant to what I'm getting to, which is I was on a short list of people to replace Mike in the X-Wing series. And Tom Dupre looked at my stuff and decided that I was the right one for it. And he kind of penciled me in on the chart and then promptly quit and went to work for Avon. And his replacement, Tom Labrudo, came in, looked at the chart and said, okay, so we got this guy Aaron working on the next set of X-Wing novels, great. Months pass and I haven't turned in any books yet. And he calls my agent and said, Russ, how is Aaron doing on those Star Wars books? And my agent said, I don't know, I'll ask him. And that was the first either my agent or I had heard about me doing Star Wars books. I was not under contract. I had not been approached. My agent had not been approached. And at the point that I found out they wanted me to do them, I was already months behind. And so in addition to the terror of dealing with fan expectations, and the fan expectations were already high because of the line of Star Wars books that had come out already, including people like Tim, like Kevin, and like Mike, I was months behind. And so I, you know, hurled myself into the research and into the writing, and I don't know whether it's lingered with me to this day, but I really realized with Mercy Kill that I experienced kind of performance anxiety when it comes to Star Wars, and they're harder for me to write, with the exception of Starfighters of Adimar, than they might be otherwise, and it might be because I was traumatized by that first three-book contract.
Just to fill in the background of that, I had done the first four X-Wing books. Nobody at Bantam thought they were going to hit the Times list. I mean, everybody thought they were just going to go out there. And when the first one hit, everybody suddenly, the plan to buy those books was brilliant. Everybody thought that was just great. You know, all four of them hit.
Everybody became a genius.
You know, number three, Krytos Trap. The week before it came out, Stephen King had six books on the paperback bestseller list, because that's while he was doing Green Mile. So everybody knew that one would not hit. It did hit and kicked one of his books off. You know, so the X-Wing franchise was going really strong. To say thank you to me, Bantam pitched I, Jedi to Lucasfilm as one of the books for the new contract. And since they were going to give me I, Jedi, they say, look, we want more X-Wing books. I was at a convention talking to Tom, and Tom said, you know, we want you to do one more, and that became Isar's Revenge. We've got another three that we want to do, and Tom said, and I want to give them to Aaron. And I said, that's great. And Tom and I talked about, you know, what Aaron could do with what characters in what area. And so that's why Aaron was penciled in on this list. And then, as Aaron said, Tom left. And so Pat Labrudo calls me up once he takes the job to introduce himself. And he says, now, I see we got you doing this thing called iJedi. And I said, yeah. And I explained to him what it is. And I said, hey, by the way, do you want me to tell you what Tom and I talked about Aaron was going to do? And Pat, because I assumed that Pat knew what was going on. I was just going to fill in some details. All Pat had was a name on a list. And so I'm the one filling him in on this conversation that Tom and I had 8 months earlier. And that's what prompted him to call your agent to say, hey, where are these things? Yeah. You know, and no one had checked to see that there was any paper. To go back to the original question, you know, I guess I was just too dumb to worry about being afraid of these things coming out, because I'd written military science fiction before, but the place where I got terrified actually was when I was doing the Union comic, the marriage of Luke and Mara Jade, and I remember I was starting issue 3. And I just kind of froze and said, oh my God, I am marrying off icons. You know, and it's like, if you screw this up, it is going to be really, really bad. And so that really is the only time that I was, that I experienced that sort of terror. And I really should have. I should have been a lot more afraid. But quite frankly, you know, being able to talk to Tim, who's very generous with advice, and Kevin, you know, they did not. What's that?
Who was not so generous?
Well, yeah, but you know, it all worked. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's yeah. And how is that firstborn of mine doing? But you know, so with guys like that, you know, being very encouraging. Again, it was not until it was like, oh yeah, wait, this is a big deal, that it came late to me. So,
with the Disney buyout and the new movies coming, there's a lot of anxiety on the parts of people that, you know, what you guys have done is sort of, it might be retconned, but that's something that you guys have been dealing with day one, you know, with the prequels coming out and things like that. How do you guys feel about the movies in any way, even small ways, overriding what you guys have done? Or, you know, how do you feel like about that?
Well, one, you know, we have had to deal with that. I mean, that's always been there. You know, someone could decide, and certainly those of us who were writing before the new movies, you know, had George make some design decisions for the new movies that overrode some of the stuff that we had done. But look, you know, I'm a Star Wars fan. I'm looking forward to those movies the same as everybody else. But as I've said in many panels, and this is going to be up to you guys to make this reality come true, I want Disney to do a live-action X-Wing series. And I want, you know, and I want us to be able to be pilots in them, so we can die, because then we can be in the Walk of Fame and sell pictures for $20, as opposed to trying to hawk books, which are really heavy, for $20. So that is my whole purpose behind that. But I think that would be a lot of fun, and I think X-Wing has got really good live action series potential. So tweet that out. You know, let's get a hashtag and we'll make that work. You know.
That's the new rumor.
Yeah. Actually, as long as we're at it, we might as well fill Thursday night on ABC. We'll have the X-Wings, we will have Jedi Knights, and we'll have the Mara Jade Chronicles.
Okay, yeah, there we go.
All starting right after Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
as for overriding, I really think that I would prefer all or nothing, which is to say, the EU is untouched and becomes the basis of the new movies, which is a wish dream. It's not going to happen. Or they start in an entirely new alternate universe that has nothing to do with anything that's appeared in the EU. Spin the EU off into something that is that can be continued separately, so those storylines and those characters don't get dropped, and forge off in an entirely new direction for the movie and post-movie era. Which I think is far more likely. You know, at this point, I just have to hope that they will spin the EU off and let people play in it for many, many years to come.
Yeah. I've worked a lot with the DC Universe and the Marvel Universe, and that, of course, has many different universes all over the place.
Oh,
that
yeah.
don't. I did a book called The Last Days of Krypton, which basically pulls together all of the stories of Krypton and makes sense out of them, which I've gotten letters of awe from, like, the head of Hasbro. Because in The Last Days of Krypton, I explain why, you know, if Krypton is the most advanced planet in 20 galaxies, how come it only has one spaceship on the planet? And why does it only get built baby-sized? And it actually makes sense in my book. And the guy from Hasbro, the head of Hasbro, read it and loved it and said, "We love this. We want to hire you. Please write the same book that makes sense out of all of our Transformers history." I tried. I really tried. And I just, anyway. What I really am most skeptical about is this whole idea of casting Ben Affleck as Vader. Is that what I heard? No, I've had to deal with, I did the anthology called Tales from Jabba's Palace, which is all the stories that I think, Tim, you were in it. Mike, were you in that one? I can't remember.
Ben Affleck was.
Affleck was. All of that stories are all these people in Jabba's Palace scene, half of which got completely overwritten by CGI when they released the special editions of the movies. Well, that book is still out. It's still in print. Mm-hmm. People still buy it all over the place. The Clone Wars changed all kinds of things for what they did, but you know what? I think it's kind of cool when I see stuff from my books in episodes of the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
And the royalty check that comes with it. You guys get big royalty checks from that, too?
Oh, huge.
It's
ones.
Huge.
Yeah.
When the Tales of the Jedi comics that I did with Tom Veitch for Dark Horse is the first place where we created this, the double lightsaber. X.R. Kun uses it. And then to see that show up with Darth Maul and everybody in the first three episodes, that's cool. I mean, I get a kick out of that. And as far as the continuity goes, you actually think Hollywood people read books? I think the thing is, what we've done in the EU, when somebody gave us, here's your original Star Wars movies, make sequels to them, you watch them, you come up with ideas, you develop them and go. Many of those ideas, like Last Remnants of the Empire still out there, or Luke Skywalker trains more Jedi Knights. Okay, they're brilliant ideas we came up with, but anybody can come up with those ideas. They put those in the new movies. That doesn't mean they stole them from our books. They just came up with the same ideas. And I was a Star Wars fan long before I became a Star Wars writer. And as a fan, I cannot wait to go see those movies, whatever's in them,
yeah.
As long as it's not Return to Jar Jar.
Address a note.
Yeah, I think there are probably ways they could bypass the EU with, you know, go a few years past it and just kind of ignore it, i.e. it's there, but we're just not going to reference it much. You could have a reference to Luke's second wife or another child or something like that. So you don't have to clear-cut the expanded universe. And I'm hoping they won't, because that helps the books to keep selling. And, you know, if there's one thing Hollywood is about, it's money. Mm-hmm. So we will see just how deftly they try to work in or to ignore or to not steamroll what we've done.
You said Hollywood and deftly in the same sentence.
I'm counting on the fact that Kathleen Kennedy is in charge of Lucasfilm and the guy who wrote Toy Story 3 is doing the script. I think they can do deft.
We will hope. If you guys, this is a question that kind of came up earlier in one of the panels about episode 7, if you guys were being consulted on some of the screenplay and there was a call to say, destroy the Millennium Falcon with Han inside, how would you guys do that?
I'd throw a planet at it.
So Mike, do you want to start?
Brian had run this question by me earlier, so I had a chance to think about it. I would just have Han in a battle in the Millennium Falcon. He's running. He goes to jump to light speed and has a misjump. He just vanishes. We don't know where he's out there. He may show up again. He may not, but that is how I would do it.
Yep. Well, you introduced a new element to the question when you just asked it that you had not before.
which is when you said with Han inside.
Ah.
Because I had formulated an answer that did not require Han to be inside. In fact, I was thinking that if we've got to destroy the Millennium Falcon and we can save Han, we would have it hijacked by 300 Gungans. And that's really all you need to know.
Fair enough.
I would love to see that happen. Not the Gungans part. I think, again, to throw the wrong franchise in here, but when Spock died in Wrath of Khan, I bawled my eyes out the first seven times I saw that movie.
It was good.
When I watched Captain Kirk die in Generations, I went, eh. Not because I dislike Captain Kirk, I just think the writer did a great job killing off Mr. Spock, and the person who killed off Captain Kirk didn't give a crap. I'm serious. And I think that if you're going to kill Han Solo, you blow up the Millennium Falcon or whatever, I'm okay with that as long as you make me cry the first seven times I watch that movie. If you just go, eh, he's old, the ship fell apart, eh. Not for me.
Yeah, I'm more with Mike on this one. I don't think you have to kill off the characters. You could run them into retirement. You could have them run away. You could have them disappear. We don't know what's going on. Conan Doyle killed off Sherlock Holmes once. He learned his lesson very quickly. And then he retired him off to beekeeping. You don't have to die. You don't have the people die on camera. You can send them off.
You would have the Millennium Falcon go over Reichenbach Falls then.
Falls. Yeah. But not with Robert Downey Jr. aboard.
So I want to open this up to questions over here. So if you guys have questions, you guys have the microphone over there, yes? I can't see through the speaker, so I'm just guessing. Okay.
Hi, Tim. I want to say first, thanks for signing my books earlier. I appreciate it. So you've all written a ton of books, created a ton of characters. How do you feel when someone does something to one of your characters without your foreknowledge? For example, I don't know.
That's a leading question, isn't it?
Tim, you created, you know, a few characters in your Heir to the Empire series, the Thrawn trilogy. And
just
then,
say Mara, man.
Yeah. I'm trying to avoid spoilers. 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 Close your ears. Aaron, you were a part of that series that she died in. Was there any sort of talk with Tim on what was the plan for her character or the twins or anything like that?
There was no conversation with me. I found out what they were going to do to Mara about 2 months before the book came out. And only then, because I asked Shelley Shapiro a direct question, and she apparently decided lying to my face was not a good thing to do. But they actually, from what I understand, there was talk about specifically not telling me what was going to happen.
Well, when I was involved in the early stages of the series, or the Legacy of the Force series, the initial idea would be that that well in advance of the publication of Sacrifice, and perhaps in advance of the writing of it, Del Rey was going to contact you.
Never happened.
And I know. That's why I was so stunned later on when I heard that you had learned about it from Malik. It's like a step got skipped. Oh, my God. So there was definitely a cock-up somewhere in the process.
That being said, we all understand that when we write for Star Wars or Terminator or Star Trek, we do not own the characters. We have created them. We have, you know, breathe life into them, but they are owned by Lucasfilm, and that's as it should be, because they own the property. Mm-hmm. And Mara would not be nearly as popular if she hadn't appeared in a Star Wars book that, you know, 10 or 15 times more people have read than some of my other things. So we know this going in, we accept it, we are not necessarily happy about it, but we take a deep breath and we decide to be adult about it, or we say, no thank you, I'm not going to write in somebody else's universe anymore. Those are the decisions we have to make, and we make them.
Is it on some level like flattering to you guys, to the work that you've done, that I mean, Mara never appeared in a movie, or Corin, or any of the other characters you guys put together, that fans are so passionate about it that when they die or something tragic happens to them, that they still come up at panels and ask how you felt about that?
Extremely flattering, yeah.
Kyle,
cosplay is even more fun.
Yeah, cosplay. I think, speaking just for myself, probably at least partially for these guys as well, when I finish a book, I do not know if it's good. I know it's as good as I can make it, but I have no idea whether the story, the plot twists, the characters will resonate with the readers.
You're too close to the material.
Yeah, and we only have our own appearance, I can't read my own stuff and be surprised. So I don't know if this is going to catch anybody, if they're going to be, you know, liking what I've done. So we hope that we will capture the reader's imagination. We hope that Mara and Thrawn and Corin will, you know, take on a life of their own, but we don't know until we start getting this kind of feedback. So every time at least one of my books comes out, I've got this little bit of trepidation. Are they going to like it or not?
I think one more follow-up on that while we're on that subject. Did you actually, how much of the other books have you guys read with characters you guys created? I mean, did you actually read the passages of the book where Mara died?
No, I mean, typically I've read, there are too many of them out there for me to read. I have occasionally had, I think Kathy Tyers in one of her New Jedi Order books sent me a copy of the manuscript before it was finalized with all the Mara spots tabbed. This was before, you know, internet stuff where she could just email, I could search, so to see if I'd gotten her voice and actions correct. And Mike and I have bounced stuff back and forth when we were both writing Star Wars. It largely depends on, I think, the social contacts the authors have to begin with.
Yeah.
As to whether, how much back and forth there is.
Not many of my characters that I, original characters from Star Wars, have been done by other writers. Perhaps most prominently, Kel Tanner appeared in a book by a guy named Zahn, and I think thought he did a great job.
So you didn't read The Death of Mara, though?
No.
Okay. Next question.
I heard enough about it that I thought I didn't want to read it.
Mr. Zahn's comments are a good lead into my question, which is jointly for Mr. Anderson and Mr. Stackpole. iJedi is one of my favorite Star Wars books. It's one that I reread the most, and it was fascinating to me as a reader, not just because it was an excellent book, but because we'd already been through this story before in your trilogy. So what was that like for you to read that book in the Jedi Temple and everything that you'd written with, you know, Corin weaving in and out of the same story? And did you guys talk about it beforehand? Was it, what kind of collaboration went into that, if any?
Well, I don't read anything Mike Stackpole writes, so.
Jealousy is really
ugly. Yes, I know.
That's a well-conceived plan.
I have known Mike Stackpole since I was 16 years old.
I was his first editor.
Yes, he was my first editor. He was 17, I think. serious. I've known him that long. You know, when Mike was talking to me that he was doing this book when I was still doing my Jedi Academy trilogy, and I kind of specifically said, I'm leaving a bunch of blank spots that you can play around in, because I don't want to tie your hands. As long as you stay within the basic storyline, run around, do whatever you want. I specifically mentioned, is that there were 12 trainees and I only named six of them, and I said you can play with the other six and do whatever you want. I'm the kind of boss you like to have, I guess.
Well, you know, for me with that book, an author I've always loved is Frederick Forsyth. In his book Day of the Jackal, he did a really good job of weaving a fictional character throughout historical events. And so in looking at iJedi, that was what I conceived of, is taking Corin and taking the events of the Jedi Academy trilogy as a historical thing. Day of the Jedi, pretty much, yeah, and just weaving things through for that piece of the book, and so, you know, we chatted at a convention, but I remember the one thing that I had to do. I did call Kevin once as I was coming down to the end of iJedi, because they were doing the Young Jedi Knights books at that point, and I said, hey, you know, Exar Kun's Temple, do you ever do anything with that ever again? And he said, Kevin says, no, I don't think we do. And I said, great, I'm destroying it. and those are the, I mean, that is, you know, a lot of the fun stuff is to be able to play within, or, you know, what other people do within their books. I mean, it makes it a lot of fun to be able to use other people's characters and try and show respect for their stuff and try and make sure that the characters all read as true.
Yeah. Next question, unless you guys have anything to add still.
I do want to make a statement and then ask a question. I resonate with the, it's not that a player, that a character dies, it's how you kill them. When Chewbacca died, I hurled my book across the room and cried like a little baby. I'm not ashamed to admit it. My question is, with the, I want to say probably the last 20 books, the Yuuzhan Vong, the Legacy of the Force, the Joiner series, the Jedi Exile series, where do you guys, and now that Disney owns the rights, where do you see them taking the expanded universe? Do you see the expansion of the Sith? You guys have kind of an idea, or is it more of a, or do you, if you were given where you would like to take it, do you have an idea of that?
That was about eight questions, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The question it sounds like is where would you take it if you guys had a blank slate all over again? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Where would you take it from the point that they just, that the last book left off with?
I think, look, one of the things that that's really important to note is that they paid a lot of money for the movie franchise because the movie franchise makes a lot of money. That is the big dog, okay? And Disney understands movies and understands television, and books and comics are somewhere further down on that line. So the movie is going to drive what goes on. That is just the reality of the thing. Now, if they invited us in, which they're never going to do, okay, because we don't have movie credentials, okay, they aren't going to invite us in. One of the other things that we do is that we do a heck of a lot more development because we get to write books that you guys spend 5, 10, 15 hours just descending into, whereas what they have to do is develop something that for 2.25 hours, they can keep you watching the expanded DVD, okay? So the depth of development we do is going to be different just because of the amount of time that we're generating. Plus, in movies, you don't get to be inside characters' heads. And that's where we get to do what we do. So, at least for me, I don't think I've got the qualifications to suggest to them where they would go. I'm just going to trust that Disney actually knows what the hell it's doing with franchises, and then I will be there on the opening day with everybody else just watching it.
Yeah, the part of the problem is that novelists think very differently from screenwriters. I mean, there are some people who can do both adroitly, but they do have to switch gears. With something like Star Wars, the things that fascinate us, the world building, the places to go and explore that no one has seen before, new characters and so forth, might spell doom for the money returns on the movies. I'm less interested in Luke and Han and Leia, as much as I love the characters, than I am in going new places and seeing new things, and that is actually wrong for the movies. So we're not necessarily the right people to participate in this. Simple as that.
Well, and for new books, kind of what Aaron was saying, I'm not as interested in going beyond those series to see what happens to those people that have been going along with those characters. I would rather go, I love my Tales of the Jedi comics set back 4,000 years before the movies. I love those, and I would love to just do a whole bunch of books in that time frame because then you're not trapped by the continuity that's been done with the other 45 books that are in and around it. I would rather just take a fresh slate and maybe one or two known characters. That was what was so cool about the X-Wing books, because I was at Lucasfilm when they were developing, trying to figure out what to do with them, and they thought, if you just take Wedge and a whole bunch of brand new characters, then you can do all sorts of things with it, and Mike and Eric did. That's what's fun as a reader. We're not talking to an average audience here. You guys are all diehard Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
But for the Star Wars fan that walks into the Amazon page,
and they just see a Star Wars book, they want to pick up a Star Wars book and read it. They don't want to go, oh, yeah, this is number 83 after the legacy of the return of the... they don't follow all of that. I mean, the number of people who have followed everything all the way through and who can just pick up a book and understand it gets kind of smaller and smaller.
They're all in this room.
They're all in this room.
But that's a really good point. I mean, you have to understand that you guys are you know, the 99th percentile of Star Wars fans. When you think about probably the best of the Star Wars novels, Tim's novels have sold, what, maybe 1.5 million units?
Probably. Yeah.
Okay, so the best selling of the Star Wars novels have sold 1.5 million units. Compare that to the number of people who have seen the movies, and then compare that to the people who have read every single Star Wars book there is out there. People who've seen movies, way the heck up here, okay? People who've read Tim's books, here. People who've read absolutely everything, you're getting highly specialized.
How many in this room have read every Star Wars book published?
God bless you.
I actually just looked up the numbers the other day of how many tickets of A New Hope sold, and it's something in the ballpark of 150 million tickets sold. So that puts things into perspective.
Yeah. Basically, the movies, they've got to write for them, not for us.
Yeah, and that's one reason why the books can't guide the movies. The movies are the big dog.
I actually have two questions, if I may ask. One is, let's say that they did take any of your books to movies. What iconic actors or actresses would you like to play them as? Like Thrawn or Corran Horn or the Jedi twins or whatnot. Who would you like to see them be played by? And then my second question is, I saw this on an episode of Castle where they have a bunch of mystery writers. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have like a science fiction writers poker club or something like that?
It's mainly about drinking scotch,
I
think.
It's about drinking high-end scotch, as a matter of fact.
Well, in terms of actors and characters, I think there's only one person that I would definitely cast, and that's Ron Perlman as Piggy.
I haven't thought about who to cast as Corran, but I know it would not be Ben Affleck. So.
I've got Luke Skywalker in my books, and I'd cast Mark Hamill.
You're a traditionalist.
Yes. Yeah. I get asked this question a lot, and I've never found a good answer to it because I don't see the characters in terms of face and body. I see them in terms of attitude, personality, intellect, how they would react, how they would behave in a certain situation. And it seems to me if you're even close to kind of the physical thought and you've got an actor, actress who can capture the character, I'm good to go with that.
As for the second question, really, in spite of the fact that many of us live in cities where there are a lot of writers, we don't necessarily hang out with those writers, but with people who are close to us as colleagues. I hang out with Mike here, for example, a lot more often than I do with Bradley Denton, who's a very prestigious science fiction writer in the Austin area. So if we have a poker club, it accumulates at conventions, and we talk about business, and in the case of Mike, scotch.
Anybody else want to venture on that?
Okay. They're sulking because we don't invite them over for scotch.
This is the first Dragon Cogan in a while. We haven't smuggled any in.
I know.
Next question.
I know in much of the previous recent books is we have a Galactic Mac now, and unfortunately we have books on all of them. However, the unknown region still remains unknown. Will we ever get to find out how the Chiss, their culture, how they were made, how Thrawn ties in all of this, and then from that, the hand of Empire, the Empire's hand.
Ask Kathleen Kennedy. I'm ready to talk about it, but she's got the rights to this.
Do you know that stuff? Do you have all that stuff worked out in your head?
Typically, I don't fill in a map until I need the area because I may come up with something better years later or something. So I do not have it all mapped out, but I could come up with something fairly easily. I could come up with as much detail as we wanted, as anybody wanted, if they asked me for it.
Shortly after the paycheck arrives?
Oh, I'd get started before the paycheck.
Okay.
The promise of it. I know Disney's good for the money.
You know where they live.
And as a writer, if you wait for the paycheck to arrive, you will never meet your deadline.
I don't know if I can one-up the story about getting off of crack in the eighth grade and saying, but Timothy Zahn, as a diabetic, you did get me to put down a Twinkie or two and become an English major, you and Kurt Vonnegut. But that being said, writing in military science fiction, especially using most of the military commanders, because, you know, the Empire being a military state, that nature, do you all use real-world military influences? Do you look at a certain character and try to compare them to a general, an admiral? Or are they just completely drawn out of experience outside of real-world history?
For me, it's mostly just I read a lot of history, a lot of military stuff, and all of the everything you read about anything goes into this massive hopper in the back of your brain, and you start pulling out bits and pieces and recombining them as you start creating characters and writing stories. So I've never based anybody on a real character or never based a battle on a real battle or anything like that, but just what kind of character do I need, what kind of character is Thrawn, what kind of character is Pelion, how would they react in this situation with this kind of battle, what would the tactics be like, and you go from there. So I can't say, Thrawn is this or that or this character. It's just this remixing that happens in the subconscious and that comes out on paper.
In a slightly different spin, when I was writing my Jedi Academy trilogy, a whole big part of that is a top secret Imperial weapons installation, the Maw installation. When I was writing that, I was working full time at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which is a top secret government nuclear weapons research installation. I had a high level security clearance. I had to go through all kinds of guard gates and access booths and fingerprint scans and real get smart kind of stuff to get into my office every day.
His Russian overlords were very pleased with him.
Yes, they were. But this wasn't so much the sexy, exciting spy stuff. This was the red tape, bureaucratic, governmental stuff. And I did some things in my big Imperial Maw installation, which is exactly like the bureaucratic junk that I had to deal with in my everyday thing, where we had one, and this is a true story. This was in California. We had this big, fat emergency response manual that we were supposed to refer to in the event of a disastrous earthquake. So as the buildings are falling apart and ceilings are collapsing on us, we're supposed to refer to page 22 of this manual and find out what we're supposed to do. And I had a scene, we got that and we were briefed on it, and I remember being a smartass raising my hand going, if the whole building's falling down, you really think we're gonna be looking in this book? And they said, well, that's what the procedure is. So there is a scene in, I don't know, Champions of the Force or something, when the Maw installation is under attack and everything's falling apart, and the administrator of this research lab announces over the intercom, everybody to refer to your emergency response manual to figure out what to do. So that's where it's based in real life.
I never based any of my military characters on real-world military personalities, but I will say that a couple of the battles in my novels were inspired, at least in part, by real-world battles of World War II, especially. The big carrier fight in Solo Command was inspired by the kind of fog of war situation at the Battle of Midway. It doesn't follow the pattern of the Battle of Midway, but some of the circumstances are similar and follow that pattern. The siege of Borlaeus in the New Jedi Order novels I did was inspired by Bastogne. And in fact, in the early outline, I referred to the planet as Bastogne, knowing that was just a placeholder. And to a very, very lesser extent, Wedge Antilles on Adumar in Starfighters of Adumar was inspired by the notion of Chuck Yeager flying missions still during the Vietnam War, which was crazy, but he did, because he was Chuck Yeager. So that's the kind of limited connection that you'll find in my books.
Yeah, I think for any writer, you end up doing research. I know for the X-Wing books, I'm not a pilot, but I watch a lot of video. I talk to pilots. I certainly read a lot of pilot biographies, as well as reading, you know, studies of aces, you know, because you want to get the sense of what it's like to be in a unit, you know, what it feels like to pull those maneuvers, the kind of things that you're looking at. You know, some of the best feedback I had was actually from pilots who would ask me what I flew, because you know, as far as they were concerned, I had to be a pilot. That's the only way you could get that right. Nothing was modeled on actual historical stuff, but certainly study of military history and bios and those things informed all of it.
But you just played that video game constantly.
I did. I burned out three joysticks.
He was constantly playing that game.
It logged a lot of hours.
Next question.
It was.
Hi. My question is specifically for Mr. Alston, but it would apply to the rest as well. I just finished the Fate of the Jedi series. And
I'm sorry, a little louder.
I just finished the Fate of the Jedi series.
Uh-huh.
And I was curious, when you're writing a series, but you're only writing a couple of the books in a series, you know, working with Troy Denning and stuff like that on the multiple books, how much, you know, when you're doing one large collaboration of one story over like 8 or 9 books, how much interaction do you have with the other authors?
Quite a lot, actually. when writing most of last two series I did with Troy and Karen and then Troy and Christy respectively, we would exchange emails every day, probably not more than, you know, probably not fewer than a couple and not more than 30 or 40, depending on how heavy we were discussing various topics. And then a couple of times during the course of the writing of any series, we would get together, usually at San Diego Comic-Con or at Big Rock Ranch or Skywalker Ranch or the Presidio or whatever, to hash out things that were best hashed out face-to-face. So we had a fair amount of interaction. And yet, even so, when trying to guide the series, I liken it to like the Three Stooges being in the front of a car fighting over the wheel. So it's actually difficult, no matter how cooperative you feel. But we did cooperate a lot and communicated quite a lot.
Were you Mo?
we traded roles, really. Unfortunately, I'm getting to be more like Larry all the time.
Did any of you guys want to discuss that?
No, I think you pretty much covered it.
Okay. Next question. We've got time for about two more.
I have a question for Mr. Zahn. Now, I love Grand Admiral Thrawn and Mara Jade, but one character I really love seeing throughout the course of the EU is Gilad Palayan. And I was wondering if you had any idea how much he would grow when you were writing him as the Watson to Thrawn's Holmes in the first trilogy.
Not a clue. No. That's a short answer. The long answer, just to get back to what was said earlier, is the Thrawn trilogy was books 1, 2, and 3 of 3. Nobody knew whether Star Wars fans existed anymore. Nobody knew if anybody cared about Star Wars. So this is the experiment that Lou Aronic has put his job on the line for, which I didn't know at the time, fortunately. So this was going to be it. Nobody expected anything else. And then the fans found the book, sometimes out of the box as the bookstore people were putting it on the shelf, and Lucasfilm and Bantam realized they had a gold mine here and immediately signed 12 more books. So not only did I not know that Pelion had a future, I didn't know that Mara or anybody else had a future. So it's been gratifying, though. Pelion is, again, I see him as a character, a solid, good, honorable man, not brilliant, not incompetent, just the kind of guy who will occasionally do good things in the military and will rise up the ranks, and is somebody you can trust. And that's kind of how he's grown throughout the books, not just mine, but others as well. And it's been gratifying to watch that happen.
Okay, last couple of questions. You guys can both get in.
Okay. I guess it's kind of related to the last question, but like, what's the most pleasant surprise you guys have gotten about later developments of like things you've developed for the universe, like characters or concepts or spaceships or planets?
Having developed obviously EU characters, but the reaction to Baron Fell and the reaction to Mirax and the reaction to Corrin has absolutely astounded me. You know, it's one of those things that when somebody comes up to you and says, oh, you know, Korin's my favorite EU character, you know, all I'm thinking is, what, with Thrawn and Mara Jade and, you know, all these other, what are you, nuts? You know, but it's really, really cool. I mean, the way that stuff's been embraced by the fans is just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I've been most pleased, I think, demonstrating that even within the main line of the Star Wars universe, which has a specific tone, which most of the books and most of the comics should in general adhere to, there is room out there for deviations from the genre that is Star Wars. Stuff like Matt Stover and his very, very hard-nosed, painful, and fascinating novels in the Star Wars universe, or Race Squadron, which has a bump of humor above that of most of the Star Wars material, demonstrating that there is room for things that are a little out of the normal. Since I'm always been kind of an outsider, it's been nice to wave the flag and have other outsiders in the readership come and flock around and say, yeah, we want more of this too. Not exclusive of the other, but in addition to the other.
For me, it's more of an unusual thing. One of my projects, I did a big art book with Ralph McCoury called The Illustrated Star Wars Universe, and every month I got to sit down with this genius artist, Ralph McCoury, and just brainstorm for a day where he would be sketching aliens and trees and weird things, and I would be making up the natural history of these things. And he did original paintings for the coffee table book that I did. And George liked them so much, he matted a bunch of them into the extended, or the new versions of the original trilogy. And I didn't know this until I went to the theater to watch it. And there they are, Lando's looking out the window of Cloud City, and there's one of the the paintings that Ralph painted it, but he and I were like, how about this? We put this in there and do that. And to me, that was like the coolest thing, sitting and watching up on the screen. That's that painting we came up with. And it's cool.
Yeah, I guess we want to go with the movies. The two times, first of all, when Qui-Gon says Coruscant, I invented that name.
Yes, yes.
And secondly, I think it's in Attack of the Clones where Obi-Wan catches Force Lightning on a lightsaber blade, which I also invented. But, wow, the tail has wagged the dog twice now. So, Kathleen Kennedy, can we try for three?
Yes.
So I've been told, Brandy told me that that's all the time we have for questions now. And then...
We can answer the last one fast. Come on.
That's what I was... Go ahead, quickly.
Make it a quick one.
I am back. I have good questions. You kind of touched on this before with the whole Disney buyout thing. You've all had to receive blessing from Lucas, you know, to write your novels and whatnot. Assuming Disney isn't stupid enough not to let you guys continue writing, do you foresee more being able to have more liberties or less liberties with your novels?
So if you guys were working in the post-Disney J.J. Abrams Star Wars expanded universe, would you have more liberties or less liberties?
I can answer that pretty definitively because I was working in the line when the prequel trilogy came out. The Lucasfilm tended to close off areas which the writers were not allowed to even approach, protecting it for the scripts and making sure that we didn't screw anything up that they had in mind, even in areas they decided eventually not to develop. So we will have less that we can explore for the first period of time, first few years, and then it'll open up again once those movies are passed.
What Aaron said.
Yeah.
That was a very quick answer, gentlemen. Okay, so are we doing what?
A giveaway of some sort?
Yeah, is that that's common procedure
a date
here?
With Aaron Alston.
Yeah. Second prize is two dates with Aaron Alston.
I don't want to know what third prize is.
Consolation. Comes 9 months later.
That's it. We should just drop the mics. Okay, you guys all have your raffle tickets out, right? Okay, so the first number on the raffle ticket is 561485.
Come on, just one.
Just one? What do you want? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what they had me. Oh, there you go. You got a poster.
Cool.
got one?
All right, yeah, I got one. Number is 561-578. There we go.
All righty. I have 561. There's a conspiracy here. 561s. 561.
There you go. Right here.
655.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yes. Cool. Yes. There he is.
There we go.
All right.
Got him in the back.
Yep. Yes. I'll let you guess the first three digits, but the last three are 479.
All right. Less distance to walk.
There you are. Thank you.
And my last three digits are 488.
I'm sorry, I was in a field there.
That's his.
Oh, right.
Yeah. No, you're fine.
But where's the...
Okay, there's one more.
He's got it.
Okay, good.
It's 600.
Too bad none of them was 666, huh?
Too bad.
Jessica. Yep.
600? Okay, I'd like everybody to thank our panelists for...
And guys, you can go see them. They will be signing, not here, but throughout the con at the different...
And come grab some of these Parallax cards. They sent me 2,000. I do not want to take them home.